Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 67, section 4, which is old single column, page 757. Okay, so as you can see from the preceding section, they just gave us a little overview of of those fundamental decision-making years of the rebellion on this world. Recall that, and in general, it didn't take all those 7 years. It would have been, it only took a couple years at the system headquarters. It would have been something similar here. In terms of the superhumans and the celestials on the planet, they would have all worked through it in short order. The mortals, it's an ongoing thing still today. So that a big chunk of that 7 years is what it appears to be the approximately 5 years travel time for the Melchizedek receivers and the Most High Observer to come from Gerasim to here to take over and set up an emergency planetary government. So that's the point we left the story, and now they, as you can see from the title here, they want to get into the immediate aftermath of that decision making process. As usual, the most primary part of the picture that they want to give us some detail about is what's most immediately relevant to the mortals, the corporeal staff, and how they're, what they do in the immediate wake of the rebellion, how that affects the entire history of the planet for the last 200,000 years. Not just in terms of civilization, as you might initially suspect, since this is an upset of the civilizational uplifters, the uplifting regime. But as we all know, this actually has a significant genetic impact on the planet as well, which we'll get into here shortly. So let's just get going and see what they've got here.
The Kalagastia 100 after rebellion. When the final roll was called, the corporeal members of the prince's staff were found to have aligned themselves as follows. Fan and his entire court of coordination had remained loyal. Aang and three members of the Food Council had survived. The Board of Animal Husbandry were all swept into rebellion, as were all of the Animal Conquest advisors. Fad and five members of the educational faculty were saved. Nod and all of the Commission on Industry and Trade joined Kalagastia. Hap and the entire College of Revealed Religion remained loyal with Van and his noble band. Lut and the whole Board of Health were lost. The Council of Art and Science remained loyal in its entirety, but Tut and the Commission on Tribal Government all went astray. Thus were 40 out of the 100 saved, later to be transferred to Gerasim, where they resumed their paradise journey.
Okay, I gave you a little advance assessment of this back in the preceding paper when we went through each of the 10 councils, you may recall. This is where it's stated, where I was drawing that information from. So you notice besides the 40-60, the 40%, 60% split that we talked about last week, overall, you have a 50-50 split on the leaders. Five of the leaders stayed loyal of the 10 councils, and five rebelled. That gives you a little indication that those who were selected as leaders, it wasn't just an arbitrary pulling a name out of a hat sort of a thing. That indicates a little measure of greater integrity in those who were leading each of those 10 councils than the 40-60 would indicate. If you can't remember, because they didn't actually give you the name in three of them, you have Bon and Dan, are the leaders there with the animal husbandry and the animal conquest advisors, and then down there with the Council of Art and Science, that's Mech, you may recall. So, that's the way it broke down. They'll get back to the issue of them being transported off here a little bit later on in the paper. So we'll come back to that issue that they're mentioning at the end. The one thing that's kind of interesting is they seem to be definitely using every opportunity to speak of Van's group, to refer to Van's group with that word coordination. You notice they did it yet again there. That kind of really strikes you. They're making a point of stressing that, because again, that's as we looked at that specific issue, it's not that any one of those 100 were lacking in consecration of will. The issue is not the father parent. The issue is the relationship to the other parent, to the mother. If you want to remain a truly living part of the cosmos, this distinction is vital, right? Living. That relationship to the whole, through the individuality of the whole, the other half of the picture. When the going gets tough, that's when it becomes apparent, pardon the pun, that there's more in play than just the existential parent. You can't remind yourself that enough, because you're trying to overcome four previous epical revelations that only talked about your initiation, only talked about the Father, because that's all we were, was just in a very initiating state. But the whole point is now we've been moved out of the sheltered bay where you're initiated. Remember, shallow seas where the life carriers initiated life, right? It's a parallel. And you have to be thinking about that other parent, your relationship to the other parent, to the mother, when you go beyond standing where you came into existence and attempt to take a first real step, the path that you're going to walk, you know, even with the very first step, is not the Father's path. The Mother's the way. She's the literal path upon which you can find solid footing. Father just initiates the thing that's going to walk. He doesn't supply the surface to walk upon. Right. Yep.
So these different groups, there's a mix of the leadership that happened. I just wonder why that leadership couldn't have carried a thread of
right. Well, you know, we'll get to that a little bit. I mean, Van set up the Ten Councils again. So you had ten councils again, with just four in each council.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So the limited degree to which they could have an impact, they did in all of them. So, I mean, that's the main reason why you don't see sort of a huge bias of, yeah, you know, the ones, the councils that stayed loyal. You know, we can look back in history and say, oh, yeah, I can actually see that those, you know, there was more of a thread carrying forward from them than there was from the ones that rebelled. No, you're going to see just a very minimal, you know, influence across the whole spectrum of the Ten Councils. And then what little Van and Amnon could do, along with the Melchizedek receivers, over those 150,000 years, yeah, a lot of that got blown up again with the default.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Chris.
Yep.
Half of these were men and half were women, right?
Yeah, so I mean, across the whole board, yeah.
So of the leaders, were any of them women?
No, see, I mean, you can, it appears from the names that, you know, you have a...
You don't know, right? It doesn't say, does it?
Yeah, it doesn't, but I mean...
Men could be.
One would suspect, you know, that you have the place direction differential. You know, the leader of the group, you know, has to be a directional individual. So my guess is they were all males. You know, you can wonder about that. You know, why would that be? Since we all know there are definitely women that can take on a definitive leadership role, you know, or go to one of the rebel worlds, you know, what about Eleonora and Penobscot, I know. But the thing to remember is that they aren't, you know, they're a lot more like a material son and daughter than we are. So that difference between the male and female is more definitive between the individual that manifests direction and the individual that manifests place is all the more distinct, especially with the primary 100, than it is for us. So, you don't have any local universes where the creative mother spirit is the creator son and the creator son is the creative mother spirit. It's just, there's a creator son, and I mean, you have a definitive delegation of tasks there, differentiation of nature. We aren't so distinctly differentiated as mortals because that would not be stable. It's a very difficult life here, and just take the parental role. It's very likely that one parent might get killed, right? And the other parent has to be able to take up some of the slack. You know, so if we were like material sons and daughters, we're basically the one can't take up any slack of the other. I mean, an Eve can't do any Adam stuff, and an Adam can't do any Eve stuff. I mean, they're just too differentiated. You know, the whole thing just collapses. You know, if one of them...
But they're not specific.
What was that?
They're not specific about male.
They aren't. But I'm just, you know, I'm just,
no, you're saying,
just pointing out that, you know, it's very likely that it's not just that, well, maybe the names just sound male to us, but they were actually a female. It's fairly likely that they were the male-sounding names are attached to males. But anyway, that's about all we can say.
Yep. Court of coordination, mm-hmm. is that used anywhere else? Just in that way, court of coordination. It's just a cool-sounding thing.
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, but yeah, you're right. The court of coordination is a. I wouldn't be surprised if that's a once expression, you know. All right, so let's keep going here.
The 60 members of the planetary staff who went into rebellion chose Nod as their leader. They worked wholeheartedly for the rebel prince, but soon discovered that they were deprived of the sustenance of the system life circuits. They awakened to the fact that they had been degraded to the status of mortal beings. They were indeed superhuman, but at the same time, material and mortal. In an effort to increase their numbers, Dalagastia ordered immediate resort to sexual reproduction, knowing full well that the original 60 and their 44 modified Andonite associates were doomed to suffer extinction by death sooner or later. After the fall of Dalmatia, the disloyal staff migrated to the north and the east. Their descendants were long known as the Nodites, and their dwelling place as the land of Nod.
Yeah, of course, from the fourth chapter of Genesis, when Cain leaves, you know, the garden and the Bible and goes east to the land of Nod. So, you know, when they say long known, yeah, you know, all the way to the point of, you know, of having the land of Nod, you know, in the Bible. So that definitely stuck very solidly for a very long time. Just one little thing you might notice, you know, why do they say sooner or later there? You know, doomed to suffer extinction by death sooner or later. You know, specifically, what's the sooner in there reminding you of? You know, remember we were recognizing that there's something about the leaves of the tree. You know, not just the fruit, you know, that has some sort of medicinal nature. Yeah. So, you know, that might be one of the things in there that, you know, they might not be able to deal with, you know, maladies, diseases, whatnot, like they could when they had the tree. It could be, but I'm just pointing out, I wouldn't be surprised if that's a little thing between the lines.
Well, they have to go to war to defend the city wall.
Right, right. I mean, it, you know, there's obviously all those issues of, you know, physical struggle too. But you know, you notice here, I mean, they're really just, you know, focusing on the mortality issue, you know, and I'm just trying to remind you there's more to it than just that they're just have some definitive longevity now and they're going to die of old age at some point. They might not live to old age, and it's not because they get a spear through their chest, you know, but it's because they get some malady that they normally could have fixed with the leaves of the tree. Okay.
So they couldn't plan for this situation. It sounds like Dalagastia at least knew enough about the biological consequences, but they were certain that they were right.
Right. I mean, again, it's not, you know, remember, they're not doing this, let's go do evil stuff and unplug ourselves. I mean, none of them are thinking that. You know, let's do what is genuinely good instead of what, you know, these oppressors are telling us is good, but it obviously, quote unquote, isn't. Right? I mean,
yeah.
Right. So, Yeah, and then, but again, you know, how would they rationalize that? Yeah, see, you know, there it is again, the foreign potentates, you know, and all of their, you know, the people that, you know, do their bidding, you know, they have no right to unplug us like this.
Yeah. Double down.
Right, so, right, I mean, that would just...
Right or not right, Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, again, you can rationalize anything, right? There's nothing that can come up that these brilliant people won't have a response for. If they had basic self-evident recognition, they wouldn't have started this little adventure in the first place, okay? Now, the other important thing there to note is, you know, they made a point of stressing, again, challenging our caricature notions of the rebellion. They worked wholeheartedly. Okay, you know, they were as earnest as the day is long. Right, you know, as sincere as they could be, at least, you know, at least to begin with. Right, until evil flips to sin. But that very fact that they, you know, that they're jumping in with every measure of the temple within, wholeheartedly, just means when things definitively transition from evil to sin, we're talking wholehearted sin. And so it's going to probably be a fairly short path to iniquity.
Wholeheartedly,
yeah.
To turn that ship around,
mm-hmm.
You know, it gets pretty slippery.
Yeah, I mean, just to find something within you that you could leverage off of to turn yourself around. You know, if it's wholehearted, I mean, there's no point of contrast, you know, that you can leverage off of. I see. So that's a little reminder of how. What kind of a slippery slope is involved when you are certain that you know what's right and you set about, you know, to realize this vision of the future that your spiritual consciousness is giving you. You know, if it only appears to be right and actually it's wrong, you know, it's going to be very difficult to get yourself turned around because it's going to snowball, you know, in an exponential fashion. That's where the humility part comes in. Right? You want to be careful about definitively willing things when you haven't very humbly given it time to be assessed. You know,
the sin part would begin. When they realize it all, or even suspect,
right? When they cease to be insincere,
that there's something wrong with this. This isn't
no.
The true path.
But it's going to be tricky because they have an incredible rationalizer leading them, Kalagastia and Dalagastia too. You know, I mean, they're going to have. You know, very elaborate, immediate answers to all their questions of doubt. It's like, well, I don't know. We just came unplugged. Are you sure that this is, you know, we're on the right track here?
So where's the line from error to sin?
Well, evil to sin.
Evil to sin.
Yeah. It's... I mean, we'll get to that in a little bit, actually.
Oh, okay.
But you know, I mean, just remember the technical issue. There has to be a deliberate aspect to what you're up to. I mean, you know, it can't be done in ignorance. There has to be a definitive recognition in play for it to go from evil to sin. But like I said, we'll get into sort of the asterisk aspect of that here in a little bit. Let's see. Okay, what else do we have here? Let's see here. I remember it's the master physical controllers that are feeding them that energy, you know, so they're just master physical controllers are pulling the plug on them. Let's see. This will come up later. Notice that it's not just the 60 of the primary corporeal staff that are going to start sexually procreating. It's all of the modified Andonites as well. So all 104 of them there, you know, the 60 plus the 44 is there, you know, they're pointing out there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's going to be, you know, I'm sure they were ordered to be as rapid fire as possible about this, you know, just start producing kids as fast as they could. You have very strong, females that, you know, can produce lots and lots and lots of children. I remember, like, you know, Eve, you know, we have that kind of strength. You know, Eve can produce dozens and dozens of children, you know, without any problem. They would have multiplied rapidly. Let's see.
If they had kept the tree, they were unplugged.
Yeah.
Okay, good point of order there.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have helped them to have keep the tree.
Yeah. And yeah, we don't know, you know, it may have been the case that until you had the Melchizedeks arrive to give definitive orders, I mean, I don't know if it was only then that the master physical controllers would have been ordered to unplug things. You know, I don't know exactly, you know, you can only speculate on exactly, you know, who has what, you know, authority at what point and whatnot for such things. But it's, you know, definitely in short order, they're unplugged.
Yeah. Do you think they had a lot of words over the tree?
Again, you know, between the lines, there was, they had to definitely take it and protect it, and but once the staff knows that you know they're not gonna, it wouldn't do them any good to have the tree anyway. Then it's just a moot point.
If they say sustenance of the system life circuits, talk about the tree at all.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, I mean, you got to remember that it's not just a magic fruit that you eat and then you live forever. I mean, it's just there to get your body, you know, that downstepped body linked into those energy inputs.
It's a catalyst.
Yeah, a catalyst or a, you know, a bridging mechanism or something. However you want to rationalize it. Yeah. Okay.
Can you give an example of something like that in science today that we know about? It takes some kind of a link or a bridge for something else to be effective, and
yeah, I mean, you know, just the very fact that you use the analogy bridge, right? Yeah. Right? I mean, you know, there's obviously all kinds of things that you know, that require an intermediary fact, you know, for whatever to occur, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, yeah, all over the place.
Okay.
Let's see. Okay, and then you know, it's in immediate context here. They don't give you a lot about the specifically where the Noddites end up. You may recall that's when you get up to paper 77, when you're, you know, talking about Adam and Eve and stuff. They give you a lot more details about, but all that's important right here is just immediately they're heading north, you know, just getting out of that immediate area. And but in short order, as you can tell from that, some of them do go over to Elam, to the east of the Tigris, and set up that long-standing Nadite settlement there that goes all the way to biblical record. All right, keep going here.
The presence of these extraordinary supermen and superwomen stranded by rebellion and presently mating with the sons and daughters of Earth easily gave origin to those traditional stories of the gods coming down to mate with the mortals, and thus originated the 1,001 legends of a mythical nature, but founded on the facts of the post-rebellion days, which later found a place in the folk tales and traditions of the various peoples whose ancestors had participated in these contacts with the Nadites and their descendants.
Wonder Woman.
So not only, as we pointed out, the obvious, having those 10 councils, each, dedicated to a specific aspect of human culture, obviously being the source for having, say, the Greek gods, each having their particular flavor of activity, this god is for agriculture, whatever. But you can see another aspect of, for instance, Greek sort of god stories, like Zeus having all these offspring with all these humans. See, that too. Goes all the way back, because obviously those peoples, those Greeks, which, you may recall, have their ties back to these, quote-unquote supermen and superwomen before they migrated over to Greece. They definitely were carrying the residual of those stories, like they're saying there.
So it sounds like they not only made it amongst themselves, but they went out and made it with the humans.
Yes, they did, yes. Okay. Yeah, and they'll state that specifically here in a little bit. But yes, they did. They would have started, they know, the genetic stuff. So they would have started amongst themselves. But over time, it just spreads. And what naturally happens.
Yeah. Do you think that those original generations of Nadites were able to directly interface with Dalagastia and the other higher beings?
My guess would be that the offspring couldn't. They couldn't see. That it would be just like it is within Adam and Eve. Where Adam and Eve can see the celestial beings, but the offspring can't. Because you're going to have this.
Less
downstepped nature,
It's a progressive thing, though. Like, the first generations can see, of Adam and Eve, they can see, and then they...
Right, but it's, even the first generation don't have as significant, an engagement as the Adam and Eve do. So, my guess would be that once all of the original 104 were dead, this started to... kind of shift into a mythical sort of a mode, as the generations, lost the literalness of, of the celestial rebels on the world. The only, little asterisk to that is, remember that there's rebel midwares, that could have kept the literalness of this alive. And it would have gotten a huge booster shot once you get to the secondary midwares, and there's rebel secondary midwares, all the more so. That this is not just our imaginings, that there's this whole, these rebel spiritual beings that no one can see and touch. So the midwares definitely, had a lot to do with feeding the dual spiritism model. that there's these unseen beings, some of them are good and some of them are bad, right? And that they have doings with humans sometimes, you know, that they have powers, you know, to engage humans some.
I would think that Caligasti and Daligasti would be very interested in trying to influence
yes.
the culture of the Nodites in any way.
Yes, right, and they tell you that they were very much doing that as much as they could, you know, and it wasn't until Pentecost that, you know, that ability was taken away from them. And you got, you know, because remember, there's also that lower unrevealed order of angels that could engage material or can engage material stuff, and there's rebels amongst those. See, so those would add to the ability for Caligastia and Daligastia to have their desires literally manifest all the way into the material doings of man. Yeah. No. Let's see here. Where were we now? I can't remember. We just did that paragraph. I guess we got everything there, didn't we? Yeah, let's keep going.
The staff rebels, deprived of spiritual sustenance, eventually died a natural death, and much of the subsequent idolatry of the human races grew out of the desire to perpetuate the memory of these highly honored beings of the days of Caligastia.
So there you see shades of what I was just referring to, that once that the original crew were gone, you kind of shift into this new mode. You know, and literally, like they're saying, a lot of the whole notion of making a clay image of a god, you know, was to try to keep the literalness, visual literalness of them alive, quote unquote. You know, when you can't walk up and give Nod a hug anymore, you know, you make a little clay Nod and you pretend that he's still here. Yeah. So, you know, again, if you ever wonder, it's like, yeah, it's so weird. Why, you know, why did humans get into that whole bit of making these little figurines and calling them gods? And, you know, see, it's you had a corporeal staff that were thought of as gods. You know, and that whole bit of made of clay, right? I mean, just all you have to do is just not take it metaphorically, but literally, right? And just make them out of clay.
So that's not indispensable in the evolution. If we hadn't had the rebellion, we wouldn't...
Yeah, so that's the sort of things they're pointing out, that on a normal world, you wouldn't have a lot of the mythology and idolatry and stuff that we have. Uh-huh. You know, 'cause you just wouldn't have had the engine that we had here to get going and perpetuated.
There is some religion, you know, like when Jesus was here, they didn't want any of that. They didn't want you to draw.
Yeah. I was just going to mention, see, the other little element in there, it's not just making, you know, these clay gods, but the whole dichotomy that got set up, you know, where if someone was worshiping a clay god, you know, you went and killed, you know, them and their entire family. You know, where did this aggressive response to that come in? See, and that's because you've got the rebels, bad people, right? And the good guys. You had the black hats and the white hats, you know. You had Van and crew and Nod and crew. And I mean, this great enmity, you know, was built up and just was perpetuated forward to these very visceral, militaristic responses, you know, of, you know, like some of the Old Testament prophets against graven images. Yeah. Okay, keep going here.
When the staff of 100 came to Urantia, they were temporarily detached from their thought adjusters. Immediately upon the arrival of Melchizedek, of the Melchizedek receivers, the loyal personalities, except Van, were returned to Gerasim and were reunited with their waiting adjusters. We know not the fate of the 60 staff rebels. Their adjusters still tarry on Gerasim. Matters will undoubtedly rest as they now are until the entire Lucifer Rebellion is finally adjudicated and the fate of all participants decreed.
Yeah, so, you know, the one little mystery that you may not have thought about there with these rebel 104 is their souls.
Yeah.
Or in the case of you know, the 60, right? I mean, their whole Marantia form, right? It's not just a Marantia brain, you know. But they had this whole Marantia nature. It's like, well, exactly how did that work? I mean, I guess you have to assume that guardian angels took possession of all those and still have them, you know, and that they'll go through, you know, the resurrection of the unjust, you know, quote unquote, you know, that whole bit of going through the whole process, you know, as if they're going to be resurrected, but their adjusters won't engage, and that'll be the end of the story. I mean, one might wonder if there'd be an exception to that normal process in this case. You know, maybe the Ancients of Days just decree, no, don't go through the rigmarole, you know, like in the case of the, you know, especially the 44, building a whole Marantia body for them, putting their Marantia brain into it, you know, that whole normal routine. You know, maybe they just, you know, it's just definitive. There is nothing there. I don't know. I mean, do we, you know, would everyone, you know, take their word for it? Or do they want it? You know, would they continue to, it's like, we're not foreign potentates. Go through the motions like you normally do so everyone can see. Right, we're not doing some arbitrary, you know, thumbs down thing here. Go through the motions, see that the adjuster doesn't plug in, they don't reanimate, you know, they are gone. You know, so you can just speculate about all that. But, you know, just to, you know, that whole bit, remember, you know, that if I go to iniquity, my guardian angels take possession of my soul. I mean, you know, the moment the, you know, if the adjuster leaves me before I physically die, my guardian angels will continue to minister to me until my physical death. They'll take possession of my soul. They will lovingly carry it to the first mansion world, right? They will oversee the building of a body, Marantia body for me. They will lovingly put that empty Marantia brain into that Marantia body. I mean, you know, just because it's obvious to everyone that I've gone to iniquity, that they still go through all of that loving ministry for me.
Yep. I don't know if there's any way we can actually know about the 44 modified Andamites, whether they went to iniquity.
Right, see, there's also, I hadn't mentioned that, there's also just the question, did all 104 actually get all the way to iniquity?
Well, they talk about that in the next.
You know? Yeah. All right, I mean, it's you know, it's coming up here with a lot of these issues. But you know, you can tell that there's a mystery here, even for the revelators, right? You know, that we know not the fate of the 60 staff rebels, okay?
It's not, they know the fate of
the rebels. They might, yeah. You know, because it may be just so much like with us. I mean, everyone, if I go to iniquity, everyone knows that, you know, because, you know, they see the pot, you know, the angels can testify that the pilot light is not there anymore, you know, so the angel knows that my adjuster is left, you know, and they don't see the glow of that, you know, interaction energy between the adjuster and my mind. But see, like I said, with the 60, you know, this is, you know, there's this whole Marantia body associated with it, so it's a very strange situation.
I mean, if your adjuster leaves, does it still tarry on Gerasim?
Well,
right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, remember when they, you know, don't take that too literally. I mean, an adjuster that's not engaged to you is is technically everywhere present, right? You know, or they move at infinite speed, or, you know, I mean, they've delocalized, right? I mean, but they say it that way. They haven't gone on to other things, right? They have whatever they're up to. You know, one eye is still on Gerasim, you know, and the potential to relocalize there and plug in into a Maranja body. You know, I mean, saying it that way is like saying the Father bestows personality upon you, as if he's doing something temporal, which he can't. I mean, you know, that's always in quotes when, you know, you say the universal Father, a purely existential being that has no relationship to time, is doing a temporal act of bestowing, you know, quote-unquote bestowing.
So they don't put that kind of weight on the fact that they tarries, quote,
Harrison. Yeah, I mean, they just, you know, they've been told by the personalized adjuster that oversees this, that those adjusters haven't been reassigned, you know, aren't off to other duties, that they're still waiting, you know, for the verdict. You know. Let's see. You know, so they aren't actually on Gerasim, they are potentially on Gerasim, if you will. You know, I mean, you know, the potential is still on Gerasim to be localized there. Let's see, anything else there? Let's see. We'll get to the loyal Andonites here in a little bit. If you're wondering, you know, when they just talk about, you know, except Van there, it's like, well, what about Amadon? You know, and, you know, and they'll get to that in a little bit. Okay, keep going.
It was very difficult for such beings as angels and midwayers to conceive of brilliant and trusted rulers like Kaligastya and Dalagastya going astray, committing traitorous sin. Those beings who fell into sin, they did not deliberately or premeditatedly enter into rebellion, were misled by their superiors, deceived by their trusted leaders. It was likewise easy to win the support of the primitive-minded evolutionary mortals.
That, I want to start with that last little one. Remember, we've speculated about it. So how well would you do in the face of Lananadec's sophistry, silver-tongued sophistry? Brilliant spiritual candy just drawing you in. it was easy to win the support of primitive-minded evolutionary mortals. Yeah. Okay, so here's, Katie, is, you know, that question you brought up. So here's what I was indicating we would get to here. Notice the subtlety they're throwing in. They did not deliberately or premeditatedly enter upon rebellion. Okay, upon rebellion, okay, but they, quote-unquote, fell into sin, okay. You know, they're explaining why they used the sort of the qualifying description of fell into, right, by that parenthetical there, you know, between the M dashes. But it's sin nonetheless. So it is deliberate disloyalty to deity, even if it isn't deliberate rebellion. I mean, at some point, you know, they're doubling down, if you will, on... you know, it's not like Nod and crew at some point said, what the heck are we doing here? I mean, let's you know, turn our backs on Kaligastya and Dalagastya and go join Van. No, they're doubling down, and, you know, and they're saying, no, we're in this for the long haul. You know, so there was deliberate disloyalty to something higher than Lucifer, you know, the deity, the personalized deity, all right, if you will, like the Universal Father. But, they definitely didn't ever want to sign up for rebellion deliberately. So you got to think about that. It's like, well, what did you think that you were signing up for, you know, when you were saying, no, we're not going to follow what Michael is saying, you know, we're going to follow what Lucifer is saying. Isn't that by definition rebellion? But again, you got to remember, that's not how they thought about it. You know, they were signing up for light and life without all the falderall, you know, to get there. You know, why do we want light and life? When do we want it now? That's what they were signing up for. You know, imagine there isn't a long evolutionary process to get to light and life. You know, it's easy if you try. All right, what am I referring to there, right? Right. right, that's what they were doing. They were, you know, they were told, you know, by Kalagash and Dalagash, you imagine, you know, getting to light and life without endless millennia of rigmarole. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Yeah. You know, oh, easy if you try. Likewise, easy to win this. See. All right, so, you know, that's the mode they've gotten into. That same mode that lots of humans are getting into these days of imagining light and life, you know, without any of the effort, struggle, conflict, you know, tribulations to get there. All right.
So this point about walking right into this trap of rebellion, not intentionally, you think, I mean, because they're telling us this for a reason. They're giving it really, really clear, and you can just look around and see these things that are going on. So you think it could change at least?
Yeah, I mean, that's the next paragraph where we really get into, well, you know, into that issue. All right.
I mean, you got to be careful about how you do it.
Right, but again, I mean, it's fundamentally not your job to go around trying to save people. You know, they have, if they're going to change, especially remember when it's sin, you can't overcome sin with goodness, right? So it's not like you're going to hit them with some gleaming goodness and they're going to turn themselves around, you know, if it's actually gotten to sin. So it has to go under their radar. You know, you have to just be living a life exhibiting a loyalty to supreme values, not trying to shine a light of recognition on them, you know, if they get any sense that from you that you're trying to, you know, enlighten them, right? Their defenses are going to go up all the more strongly, right? This has to go under their radar if you're going to make an impact. But the impact that can potentially be an effective one is an indirect one where you're just living a contrasting life. Now, and if there's any possibility for them, if they have any ears to hear and eyes to see left in them, right, you will be something that is worth looking at, right? It's your job, it's your duty to be something that's worth looking at if someone on the planet opens their eyes. It's not your job to open their eyes. Yeah. Again, it's your job to achieve some measure of self-mastery so that if someone, anyone, you know, isn't sad to record and actually opens their eyes, there's something worth looking at on the planet.
As a father, I think that's important for me to try and help open the eyes of my kids.
Yeah, but remember, you have a limited ability after age 8, you know, kind of,
you're so
you know,
right, as we all know.
Yeah.
But still,
yeah,
have a hard time not at least trying.
But just remember that the most effective thing is not precept or even example. I just don't ever forget that tadpole paragraph. You know, as a parent, it's very important to remember that tadpole paragraph, that what those children will be most impacted by is not is your exhibition of loyalty, not...
I still, you know, I still have to try and do it wisely. Let's go back to these guys who rebelled. You know, first of all, they got all the way to Jerusalem and they didn't fuse. You know, who knows what kind of their history they came out of, what kind of planet they came off of originally. Now they've been here for, what, 300,000 years approximately. Who knows if that's the longest they've even existed? You know, whether they, how long were they, where they got to Jerusalem. And so they're in here going, and what the point I got out of this was things you've stressed before. These brilliant beings are telling them, you know, hey, this is the right way to go. And, oh, by the way, the system sovereign's backing us up, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they came from and everything. So I can see, you know, it doesn't, it's not, you know, unreasonable for to see that they would be easily beguiled. They could easily be beguiled and think they might be doing right.
Yeah, and that's the point I hadn't gotten to yet that I was going to bring out, that first part of that paragraph.
So let's go, question on
that. Yeah.
At what point, you know, is that sin and iniquity versus error? Error and evil, let's say. You know, when you go through it, you learn a lot about those four terms in your read your answer.
Yes.
Which is different. And it seems like, you know, we know what happened to some of them later. You know, they all, you know, Michael came and offered mercy to all of them, right? And, but you just wonder where, you know, we talk about life today even, you know, when you try to make decisions that you think, you know, you try to make the right decision you can. And maybe you're not doing it right. But in this particular situation, you know, I can see how, at least in the beginning, how they could have gotten duped. You know, you probably see, you've mentioned that too.
Yeah.
We would, as you've said many times, most of the people in this room probably would have gotten duped if we were able to see a being like that.
Right. So, I mean, definitely, you see, that was the point I was going to make. That first part. Is, you know, to not forget what they say at the beginning there. It was very difficult for such beings as angels and midwives to conceive of brilliant and trusted rulers like Kalagashya and Dalagashya going astray. Okay, so initially, you know, they're just loyally, dutifully following their leaders as they've been instructed to basically follow them without question. And so, you know, it's definitely what they're doing, technically, is just error and evil.
In the beginning,
right? Especially, see, in their cases, they're stressing there. I mean, you know, it's completely not sin to begin with because, as they're saying, they were misled. You know, they weren't wrong. They were wrongly led. Okay? So, you know, it starts out as, you know, innocent error and evil. But, you know, without describing exactly how this all, you know, descended, as it were, you know, it did eventually, those beings who fell into sin, you know. So Nod, for instance, just pick on Nod. You know, Nod starts out ignorant. You know, it's like, you know, he gets the whole rationalization scheme from Dalagashya. It sounds airtight to him. And he knows he's supposed to basically trust him unquestioningly. I mean, the fact that Van is questioning him so much, is that rebellion? I mean, is it not rebellion to question them? Right, so that's where he is. You know, and so he said, "No, I'm going to stay where I'm pretty sure it's safer. I mean, I know that I made it all the way to Gerasim and didn't fuse. You know, I'm not very rock solid yet. I've got to trust that my leaders know what they're doing. You know, I don't want to get all self-righteous here and think, no, you know, forget them. I know what's right. You know, he's being humble, sincere, trusting, right? Patient that, you know, maybe it seems a little weird, but you know, over the long haul, it'll become clear that it isn't bad. He knows how Caligasta is one of these cutting-edge individuals that you need to look at it over a long span of time to really appreciate the beauty of what these sorts of atypical actors are up to. But at some point, Nod, he's not disconnected from his encirclement in the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit is continuing to illuminate his mind. Yeah, and all that illumination is initially above his conscious level, but eventually that illumination reaches the consciousness in his mind, and he goes, oh, no, that's not right. All right, at one point, it finally dawns in Nod's mind that that's wrong. That what he's been doing is wrong. But just like all of them, he's so far down the road, they don't have the courage, as Katie was saying, to say, what on earth was I thinking? Am I an idiot or what?
And they say that sometimes.
And so they double down. Okay, and then it's sin, and it goes to sin. Yep.
you kind of picture what happened in Germany. The leaders are going in a certain direction. And here's this some schmuck, following his leaders. Mm-hmm. Suddenly one day he realized he's got the job of turning the knob on the gas chambers.
Yeah.
That's his job.
Yeah.
He's got to realize what he's doing at some point.
Yeah.
But can he stop?
Yeah. I mean, in a case like that, just the fear of death, might keep him from... It's like, well, if I stop turning the knob on the gas chamber, they're going to kill me, right? And fear of being executed keeps you turning the knob, right? But at that point, so you've become insincere. And again, it's a little more complicated with someone like Nod, right, than some, schmuck, a German soldier or something. But you don't want, he's not immune to social pressure. There's this whole group, of 104 supermen and women, plus all the celestial, all the angels, seraphim, cherubim, whatnot, that are all in here with Caligasta and Daligasta. There's a tendency to go along to get along. Right, even amongst someone like Nod. So again, courageous and independent cosmic thinking. It all boils down to that. Right? You gotta have the courage and you have to have the internal integrity to not be socially desperate. Like I said before. Right? That going along to get along thing. I mean, people will do some pretty stupid stuff, to stay in, in the likes on their Facebook page, as it were. Yeah, I mean it's so, this is the angels feel that. I mean. Remember how they tell you, seraphim are not that different from you. They experience a lot of things like you do. They don't have animal, feelings and emotions and stuff. But right, but that group pressure thing, right? You don't have to have the fifth adjutant to have a social impulse, right? All mindedness in the in the cosmos has effectively the social impulse, even if it isn't literally individuated like it is with us as a separate adjutant, right? there's an impulse there. It's like, oh, I don't want to, you know, I want to stay with my group here. We got a great thing going here. I love them, they love me, or so we say to each other. So, yeah, that those sorts of insidious issues that so many find it impossible to step apart from. You know, like courageous and independent. Okay, so, but yeah, you know, the final paragraph here, when we read it, you know, they're going to explain a little bit more about this whole fact that, you know, they didn't go racing headlong, you know, deliberately into sin. There's a little bit of quote unquote fell into sin. So, you know, there's a possibility that once, you know, once all the torches are snuffed out, you know, and the banners are, you know, are laying in the dirt, you know, you'll kind of snap out of it and go, oh my, I'm so sorry, I didn't, you know. I'll do KP duty for millions of years, you know, whatever it takes. I just, you know, you know, try to make up for this stupid thing that I've just done, right? Yeah, and remember, there's kind of a reference, like, you know, that they've been given these sort of menial tasks, you know. So I, you know, I guess, you know, give me a toothbrush and I'll scrub the latrines, you know, on the first mansion world, you know, or whatever. Okay, so yeah, so let's read this.
The
that was grace.
So if they assign it,
well, there aren't for Marantia beings. Adam and the material sons and daughters need a restroom. And all the other unrevealed beings that might need them too.
The nursery, they need cleaning.
Yeah, the nursery needs diaper changing, and yeah. Okay, let's read this final paragraph.
The vast majority of all human and superhuman beings who were victims of the Lucifer rebellion on Gerasim and the various misled planets have long since heartily repented of their folly. And we truly believe that all such sincere penitents will in some manner be rehabilitated and restored to some phase of universe service when the Ancients of Days finally complete the adjudication of the affairs of the Satania Rebellion, which they have so recently begun.
Okay, just the little issue there at the end. For, I mean, remember, if you I'll help you to recall if you don't remember, when they say which have so recently begun, you know, it was right somewhere there at the beginning of the 20th century that they got the ball rolling on the whole adjudication process. Satan was rounded up, you know, and put on the prison world, one of the prison worlds. And, yeah, so that's what they're referring to by, you know, literally, you know, as they were working on the revelation, that occurred. You know, they never tell you exactly what year in there, but somewhere there in the, you know, very early part of the 20th century. Okay, and then, you know, I mean, you were kind of referring to it. Maybe it'd be fun to just remind you of some of the details, you know, when they're talking about this whole bit of them repenting. We'll go back and read that. But first, you know, notice that they made a point, and you kind of stressed it when you read it, heartily repented. Right? There has to be something equivalent to the wholehearted, you know, way they jumped into it. They have to wholeheartedly turn around. Yeah, so they're stressing that. You know, again, doing that various misled. Right? So they're stressing that issue of people, you know, in many ways, initially, innocently, just getting sucked into the wrong flow that the leaders have set up. And but again, you see that, you know, and we truly believe, it's like, you know, it's not like they say, but we absolutely know or something like that, okay? I mean, you know, they never are going to state something definitively, unless it's definitive. But, you know, if you want, you can follow along. I'll go ahead and I'll read that whole paragraph. It's back on Singlecom, page 610. It's paper 53, section 9, the first paragraph. Let's just remind ourselves of exactly what they're referring to there. It says, "In the early days of the Lucifer Rebellion, salvation was offered all rebels by Michael. To all who would show proof of sincere repentance, he offered, upon his attainment of complete universe sovereignty, forgiveness and reinstatement in some form of universe service." There you see them repeating that "some form" sort of thing, like they were saying we just read. None of the leaders accepted this merciful proffer, but thousands of the angels and the lower orders of celestial beings, including hundreds of the material sons and daughters, accepted the mercy proclaimed by the Panoptians. So right away, the Panoptians were involved in the kind of the rubber meets the road logistics of this. Proclaimed by the Panoptians, and were given rehabilitation at the time of Jesus' resurrection 1900 years ago. These beings have since been transferred to the Father's world of Gerasim, where they must be held technically. And remember that, if you want to get really technical about the technically there, it's not literally that primary satellite, the Father's world. You know, it's the seven sub-satellites that are being used as the prison worlds, the seven around the Father's world. Where they must be held technically until the Uversa courts hand down a decision in the matter of Gabriel versus Lucifer. But no one doubts that when the annihilation verdict is issued, these repentant and salvaged personalities will be exempted from the decree of extinction. These probationary souls now labor with the Panoptians in the work of caring for the Father's world." I always joke, is it KP duty? What is it? I think it's even in that section too, come to think of it, they talk about, "It is true that Satan did periodically visit Kalagastia and others of the fallen princes right up to the time of the presentation of these revelations, when there occurred the first hearing of Gabriel's plea for the annihilation of the arch-rebels. Satan is now unqualifiedly detained on the Gerasim prison worlds." Yeah, that's in that same section. So that's what they're referring to there, reminding you of that back there in the Lucifer Rebellion papers. It's just the kind of the interesting thread through all those facts is that rehabilitated and restored, well, but not exactly. I mean, it's not a reversible process that they've gone through. They can't go just exactly back to their old duties as if nothing happened. Things will be forever different for all those individuals. They will have different duties. I mean, in some ways, maybe they can serve in ways that, say, the other material sons and daughters that didn't join the rebellion couldn't serve. Right, because they have experiences, they have wisdom. They might be given responsibilities that those who remained loyal, You know, so it's a little bit of the prodigal son sort of a thing. It's like, wait a minute, I was loyal to you the whole time. Why are you doing the fatted calf for, you know, for this doofus that came back, right? Right? Right, so there may be a little bit of that, you know, where they're actually given given a relatively honored position in recognition of the kind of ability to, you know, at least when all was said and done, to see through that, the sophistries. So who knows? You know, you can speculate. All right.
I had another question. From the side thing you just read.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It said, not one leader accepted. None of them had the courage in the... You know, it says...
Yeah, well, what you're getting at is like, well, is there something besides the courage issue? And there is. Notice what it said right after that. None of the leaders accepted this merciful proffer, but thousands of the angels and the lower... You know, they stress the lower, right? The more spiritual you are, in other words, in this case, the higher the being... the more self-righteous you can be, right? It's a double-edged sword. Relationship to spirit is very much a double-edged sword, and it gets sharper the higher you go. The other blade cuts all the more deeply. Lowly seraphim can't achieve the levels of self-righteousness that a Lananadec can. So, and again, just recognize how that is challenging that that sophistry that spirit is innately divine. You know, that if I'm spiritual, I'm by definition on the right track. No, the more spiritual you are, plus, I see by your fruits that you're quite ignorant, the more likely it is that you're on an irreversible wrong track. Right? You can be, it's easier for a Lananadec to be wholeheartedly negative than a seraphim. Right? The more spiritual you are, the more wholehearted you can be, you know, the more unity you have to span the whole within you. You know, and in order to span the whole, you need unity consciousness. If you have nothing but individuality consciousness, you're stuck in a, you know, in a localized region of the whole. You can't spread yourself to the whole, across the whole spectrum of the whole. And you need spiritual consciousness. And the more you have, the easier it is to span the whole and be wholeheartedly off on a tangent. So that's... that's the fundamental physics of why it is like that. The flip side is, okay, if I'm, like I pointed out, well, when you have the adjutants, you know, when you have your mind all split up into adjutants, that courage aspect, you know, is a separate adjutant, the third adjutant, that's a spiritual adjutant, a foundational spiritual adjutant. The more spiritual I am, the more courageous I can be. You know, the better leader I could be. But it's a double-edged sword. You just have to remember it's a double-edged sword. Right? So the more potentially courageous you can be, the more you must have a clear recognition of your personal responsibility and be exercising rigorous self-control, lest that energy that can power courage, power your iniquity.
Look to Jesus.
Now, so again, you know, be careful what you ask for. You know, Lord, make me a great leader among men, you know, that I may lead them to light and life. Well, be careful what you ask for. That's what Kalagastya asked for and finally got.
In fact, has any Lananadec ever been rehabbed?
in Lebanon?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how, you know, it may be that, you know, there's a sort of a dividing line,
Jesus,
you know?
Jesus did save a rebellion world. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
But you know how those, you know, you remember how it goes in those stories with the other bestowals.
Yeah, they don't turn.
Yeah. Right. You know, they may acknowledge the majesty of Michael, but say, yes, but.
Yeah. Even now,
I still really love myself right. more than I love you.
Right.
Right.
It was Lutentia, I think.
Right?
Said something to that.
Yeah. See, so just. Yeah, you know, again, it's the more spiritual you are, the easier it is to fall in love with yourself. If someone is very prosaic, you know, humility is just kind of just innate, right? Because pride is a spiritual thing, right? If you're not very spiritual, you can't be prideful. You know, you're just kind of naturally humble. You're not going to fall in love with yourself. You look in the mirror and you go, oh, boy, okay. yeah, you go, boy, I sure am glad that God loves us absolutely, not relatively. Because when I'm looking out in the mirror, only a mother could love. All right.
Five, immediate results of rebellion. Great confusion reigned in Dalmatia and thereabout for almost 50 years after the instigation of rebellion. The complete and radical reorganization of the whole world was attempted. Revolution displaced evolution as the policy of cultural advancement and racial improvement. Among the superior and partially trained sojourners in and near Dalmatia, there appeared a sudden advancement in cultural status. But when these new and radical methods were attempted on the outlying peoples, indescribable confusion and racial pandemonium was the immediate result. Liberty was quickly translated into license by the half-evolved primitive men of those days.
Okay, so you know that paragraph describes very directly, you know, what is what we're quivering on the very brink of happening on this world, right? What the emergency situation is. The doctrine of false liberty, you know, is becoming very seductive. And, you know, if it's allowed to be universally proselytized, this is what will happen, right? It will be, you know, just as they're describing there. You know, because you know that there's an awful lot of voices that want to have revolution displace evolution. You know, just that, because the more spiritually conscious you are immaturely, the more impatient you are. You know, and the more of your signs have the word now on them, right? The more of your nonprofit organizations have the word now in them, etc. You know, you got the word now everywhere, right? You know, that's the revolution word, right? Instead of the evolution word. No, gradually for me, thank you. And notice that how sneaky this is. For those that joined the rebellion, I mean, on the corporeal staff and stuff. Among the superior and partially trained sojourners in and near Dalmatia, there appeared a sudden advancement in cultural status. You know, it's like, so Dalagashi and Kalagashi go, see? Right? I mean, you don't have to go through thousands and thousands of years to get light in life. You just do it. Right? All right, but it's only apparent progress. It's not real. Yeah. And that's, you know, so that's a very important element there. And just, yeah, just one second. And then, see, but the contrast, you know, that, you know, even amongst those that had started out, apparently there was this great progress. That's at best a minority possibility, you know, and for everyone else, instead of that wonderful progress, you know, what do you get? Indescribable confusion and racial pandemonium, all right, just the orgy of darkness and death. So
you know, you were talking, Barb, a little bit about how you compare that to what's going on here. It seems to me that a lot of the more progressive countries, you know, are trying to turn a lot of the tribal countries into democracies without going through the process, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it seems to be caused a lot of problems, as you can
yes,
see.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem that they recognize that. It seems that people just think that that's, you know, got to be done, and if you don't do it, then you're not part of the world, and
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, and
not a simple thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as soon as we're done with this paper, you know, what do? We start reading The Evolution of Civilization. You know, that whole, they're going to teach us, you know, how that works. That, you know, you can't build nations. Nations have to grow into existence. Tribes grow into nations. You know, you don't build tribes arbitrarily into nation constructs. And you can see some of the sorts of things like we were talking about, that when people start to recognize that you can't build nations, if for no other reason, they learn by leaping, you know, even though they couldn't learn by looking, when they point this out to those ideologues, you know, that are the leaders of this concept of building nations, those people just double down all the more. You know, it's like, well, not only am I going to try to build nations, but I'm going to try to get rid of you, you know, as this ignorant voice trying to thwart progress. You know? Yeah. So remember, that's the fundamental thing, and that's why I used that word progress. It's now completely overwhelmed what used to be a genuine left-right differential. You know, is this gospel of false progress, this false gospel of progress, I should say it precisely that way, this false gospel of progress, you know, where you took the word progress, which is this very enticing word, and you constructed a false doctrine, an ism, and gave it, incorporated the word progress into its name, so that all would be drawn to it, you know, with visions of sugar plums dancing in their heads.
Now it's a manifesto.
Right? I mean, it's, you know, progress, yes, but not progressivism, not the ism, you know, predicated on false principles, you know, that is goes under that banner. You know, this, that's, you know, you began to have the Lucifer Rebellion manifest on the planet, this desire for building progress, you know, building the progress through the developmental epics rather than, you know, being grown through the developmental epics. You began to have that, you know, around the beginning of the 20th century when we got to be spiritual enough to power that desire, and at the same time we began to lose sight of the philosophic integrity that would have informed us of the fallacies that we were adopting in this quest to just build something that's advanced out of our own inner enlightenment, you know, so to speak, our own innate divinity. Yeah, so, I mean, As soon as you had progressivism manifesting, see, that's the Lucifer rebellion beginning to literally find a voice on the planet. Yeah, and yes, we all know that most of the people are innocent and ignorant. But see, we were just reading about that. That's the deal, right? It's always the case, even when you're talking about celestial beings, that most are initially completely clueless and ignorant and just get sucked into this because they don't have the insight and wisdom to discriminate and say, no. I don't think so. So we're in the exact same mode. This is just completely relevant. That's what we need to wake up to. And the only people that get sucked in to this false doctrine are those with some spiritual consciousness. Because that's the doorway in. If you don't have any spiritual consciousness, you won't find those notions intriguing. You won't feel any spiritual gravity towards those ideas. You're not pulled by spiritual gravity. You live a very prosaic, material gravity life. You live in the grace of the safety of material gravity.
Okay. One of the clearest indications of the ignorance that we live in is how commonly people will describe our system of government as a democracy, not recognizing that democracies are inherently unstable and that that's an indication we're already on a slippery slope.
Right.
Trying to idealize democracy as the ideal, and it's not the ideal. It's the ideal, but it's not the correct. It's not the idea.
It's not a proper evolutionary idea.
Right.
I mean, again, it's you get enough spiritual consciousness where you develop a bias, and if someone puts a sphere of equity in front of you, you don't see a sphere of equity. You're biased to your spiritual consciousness. You see a plane of equality. If someone puts a republic in front of you, you don't see the sphere of the republic. You see the plane of democracy. Right? You see that there's the essence, the spiritual essence of the republic is a democracy, but you can't. There's no substance to a two-dimensional plane, right? You need a three-dimensional sphere, something that's attuned to the wholeness of reality. This is what you see all. You have that basic problem all over the place. Well, that you eventually get people that have enough spiritual consciousness that they can actually have a spiritual bias. They can be biased to a spiritual eye, it's kind of a, you veer off track quickly. You get to the point where you even forget you have another eye. I mean, because it's just so tantalizing what you see with your spiritual eye. The material eye gets lazy. And eventually you just kind of totally forget you have it. You don't even ever open it, you half of you is asleep. And so it just quickly devolves and unravels when no one can see three-dimensionally anymore. And it's very difficult to turn that around. If someone doesn't have depth of perception, it doesn't do any good to show them a three-dimensional object. That's the emergency. We're getting into that mode. But don't ever, I often speak about this, but it's not like I don't understand that most people are innocent and ignorant in this, just like they were 200,000 years ago. But that doesn't mean there isn't still a major problem. Just because most of the angels were, you know, fundamentally innocent in this doesn't mean there wasn't a rebellion. There wasn't a system-wide emergency. Okay. So, all right. Let's see. What else we have there? We have the whole liberty license, you know, and, you know, that's, you know, it's worth just reminding ourselves of that sentence. Of all the perplexing problems growing out of the Lucifer Rebellion, none has occasioned more difficulty than the failure of immature evolutionary mortals to distinguish between true and false liberty. And that's the biggie. See, and true and false liberty, two-dimensionally, are indistinguishable. Right? True and false, those are three-dimensional words. If you can't see three-dimensionally, there is no such words describing three-dimensional difference. Right? Two-dimensionally, in the spiritual plane, true and false liberty are exactly the same. It's not like one is white and one is black. So anyone can tell them apart. If that was the case, none of the angels would have gone astray.
Yeah, liberty and not liberty.
Right.
Liberty, not liberty.
Yeah. So this is the problem. The word true is a three-dimensional word, and if you have no depth of perception, if you don't use both eyes in a balanced way and can't see three-dimensionally, quid est veritas? Right? It's a completely meaningless word. Just as it is to a flatlander to try, you know, how do you describe to a flatlander, a literal flatlander in the two-dimensional story, what a sphere is? Right? He knows what a circle is. But, you know, sphere doesn't mean anything. Right? That's what we're talking about. Someone can only see two-dimensionally. The only word they have is equality. That's why they use it so much. Why the word equity is kind of just disappearing from common usage? Because that's a three-dimensional word. Two-dimensional beings will never use that word. And it's a meaningless word. It's like, I don't know what the heck this word's in the dictionary for. Well, you know, why don't we just get rid of it? doesn't mean anything.
We only count to two.
So, see, and again, there's nothing bad about your spiritual eye, just as there's nothing bad about your material eye. But both will not serve you well in and of themselves. You need both eyes.
Wisdom.
Yeah, and there's a whole. Yeah, I mean, eventually you'll get to wisdom. You know. If you are initiated by having the two eyes open, again, that whole story is told in the Discourse on Reality, up in paper 130. All right, let's see. I think we touched on everything there. I'm always going to stress, I got sidetracked. You know, if you ever wondered what do they mean technically by the orgy of darkness and death, I mean, it's a kind of sort of poetic way of saying it. Right? I mean, here they're being more technical. Indescribable confusion and racial pandemonium. So in other words, it's just the cosmos is gone and chaos now reigns again. Right? That whole Greek concept of you know, what the contrast is between the way things are supposed to be and what they're like if they aren't, right? The word cosmos describes the nature of reality, and chaos is in contrast to that. And cosmos is a three-dimensional word, and chaos is a three-dimensional word in the negative. All right.
Very soon after the rebellion, the entire staff of sedition were engaged in energetic defense of the city against the hordes of semi-savages who besieged its walls as a result of the doctrines of liberty, which had been prematurely taught them And years before the beautiful headquarters went down beneath the southern waves, the misled and mistaught tribes of the Dalmatia hinterland had already swept down in semi-savage assault on the splendid city, driving the secession staff and their associates northward.
There you see the north, like I said, almost, you know, just totally immediately, they just went northward. And then obviously from what they said before, not too long later, some of them went to the east. Okay, so I think everyone is noticing it because I've stressed it. But you see how often they're using these words with the MIS prefix, like I told you they were going to do right up front when we started? You know, wrongly led, wrongly taught, right? And, you know, a word like misspelt is a complete false exaltation, right? The incorrect order of letters in a word has nothing to do with right and wrong. Right? But we, you know, we use that, you know, in our ignorance, we sort of just diffuse that, you know, the words right and wrong to everything, including the, you know, incredibly trivial. Like not the all the proper letters in a word. Yeah. The revelators are not, you know, when they say misled and mistaught, they mean literally wrong in contrast to right. Evil is innate in what's going on. Evil's inescapable. No matter, it doesn't have, sin is not automatic. You know, but evil is definitely, they're saying it is definitively an evil phenomenon, no matter how innocent the person. If they're following this, you know, they've given badness form in their mind. There is evil within them, and they've begun to bear its fruits. Okay, let's see, what else do we have there? There it is again. Very soon after the rebellion, the entire staff of sedition. Right? Just want you to notice that that's when the rebellion begins to definitively manifest on the planet, you should be looking for when it's appropriate to start using that word again. Right? That's an appropriate word. When are you starting to have, a definitive phenomenon where people are sowing discontent, resistance, and rebellion? When is there sedition?
The dictionary uses the definition for sedition as, or one of them, is resistance to authority.
Right, and like I said, I mean, the key words...
And that word resistance...
Yeah, the key words are discontent, resistance, and rebellion, no matter what, how else you couch the definition of the word. I mean, those are the sedition words. When someone looks at resistance and sees goodness instead of badness, see, it's flipped.
Well, it's a fan, you know. You look at him, and he was...
Yeah, but see, so you're going, well, oh, so... What's the deal there? See, I mean, you need to be very precise in the words, and that's what I was kind of getting at. If you're very imprecise, you think, oh, no, that's the appropriate word. Like, it was the American Revolution. No, it wasn't. It was the French Revolution, but it wasn't the American Revolution. See, we haven't gotten precise enough in our philosophic use of words to not inappropriately label what happened as the American Revolution.
Well, what would you label it?
Yeah, that's see, we hardly have words for some of these things. But when you listen to the Founding Fathers talk about it, and they speak about how humble they were in it, and how they in that humility of recognition, they could see the presence of providence in play. So in other words, it's not so much as it might appear. It's more of a suddenly of evolution. Right?
They had to use resistance, though.
But see, again, I mean, you've got to... I mean, Van wasn't resisting Nod and crew and the Caligash. I mean, like we pointed out, he didn't stay there within the walls and resist. He took himself out. Again, it's not resistance that he did. He just set up a parallel voice. He's going to be an example of loyalty to supreme values. Right? And no one is going to be coerced or whatnot. No, everyone can freely go between the two camps and choose. Just like on Gerizim. Right?
Gabriel did the same thing.
Right?
Remember
one of the how illogically absurd it is to resist evil. Evil's not a something. It's the absence of something. How effective are you going to be at pushing nothing? Where are the handholds on nothing?
What about driving the bullocks from the temple?
Yeah, and everyone, of course, goes to, you know, the temple thing, and how corrupted our interpretation of that is. It's very difficult to not put new wine in old wineskins on that one. See, and that's always been the battle cry of justifying.
That's why I asked him.
Yeah.
I mean, the American Revolution is the same thing. There had to be resistance, or else we wouldn't have this country.
Right, but I mean, they're not. Yes, there's the physical issues of war and stuff like that. Okay, but you're setting up an alternative philosophic domain. You know, they weren't trying to somehow resist, you know, England's governmental philosophy. Saying, okay, you guys can be there, we'll be here. We're going to do it different.
Fire war.
Now, of course, that's going to lead to a physical reaction, and you have to deal with that. But see, again, remember, you have to keep the philosophic part separate from the material part. You have to be very cautious about that word resistance, because as I'm trying to stress, it's very easy to get yourself turned around and rationalize. No, resistance is good. Resistance is essential here. It's very easy to see, and just think about that. I mean, obviously God has dropped the ball. There's no way that he's going to, I mean, if I don't resist this, see, what do you call that kind of thinking? Self-righteousness. No, the universe is innately right. It doesn't need you to fix it. It doesn't need you to resist things. And the fact that sounds so weird, that's because we've been marinating in the sophistries of the rebellion for 200,000 years. It's so hard for us to not have little shades of the Lucifer Manifesto in our minds and think in those terms.
Well, there's a difference between that and self-mastery in your own life. You know, I mean, it starts out resisting sometimes before you get to that point.
Yeah, but right, you know about when they talk about those. You know, I mean, how you know the whole. You know, it's just like Jesus. You know, flipping the golden rule to a positive mode instead of a negative mode. All those sorts of things. I mean, to get to the point where you aren't resisting yourself, you're mastering yourself. Right? Yourself is not evil, so that it needs to be resisted, like the story has always been. No, this self was made by God. Right? And it's you're to find the reins on it. You know, it's to be personality managed. That's the only thing that's missing with yourself. It's not innately bad. It's just you aren't managing it. It appears to be bad because you're not managing it. You're saying, well, I'm supposed to manage it? Why doesn't God manage it for me? Oh, so you don't want free will. Well, you should have asked to be an animal then. Right? Okay. Okay. Yeah, let's keep going here so we can wrap it up.
The Kaligastya scheme for the immediate reconstruction of human society in accordance with his ideas of individual freedom and group liberties proved a swift and more or less complete failure. Society quickly sank back into its old biologic level, and the forward struggle began all over, starting not very far in advance of where it was at the beginning of the Kaligastya regime, this upheaval having left the world in confusion, worse, confounded.
Yeah, confusion heaped upon confusion. That's all fairly straightforward, but just, I have to point out, notice how they're giving you the contrast between freedom and liberty there. We've talked about that some. Liberty is a spirit word, a unity word. See, so they're reminding you that. I mean, you're, as you go from an individual to a group, the associativity of a group results from in the relationship of individuals to unity. Right? Associativity is the superadditive consequence. So they're using that differential between the individuality, and even the, rubber meets the road sort of material nature of the word freedom in contrast to the word liberty there. They're never missing an opportunity to try to get you to reflect on that and get more precise, and then to recognize that the big issue is not mere freedom, whether or not you have shackles on your ankles. There's a high degree when all is said and done of six and one, half a dozen another, whether or not you have shackles on your ankles or not. The very powerful and hence potentially problematic element is liberty. Right? And that word liberty resides in your temple, in the upper domain of your mind. And it has this double-edged sword quality to it. Very powerful word. Destroy yourself with a spirit word like that. Just like a spirit word like pride, you can destroy yourself with a word like that. And because of that, all of that spiritual energy, it proved a swift and more or less complete failure. So again, it's just that's the way the geometric thing works, the mustard seed thing works.
And swift was about how much time? A couple hundred years,
I think. They get into that later on. Yeah, we won't. Yeah, let's not unpack that right now.
I have a question.
Yep.
Kaligastya's rebellious ideas, were they basically identical to Lucifer's teachings, or did he kind of have his own twist on it?
The deal with Kaligastya, like we talked about before, is that he was very much in with Lucifer from the beginning. So they were on the same page very precisely. One could speculate that some of the other rebel planetary princes might have had a little bit of a different flavor. But I think there's probably no space between Lucifer and Kaligastya. I'm sure they were very, very in tight agreement on all the details of how this was going to play out. Just because they were so
They were buddies before.
Yeah, they had worked on it beforehand, you know, so intimately. Yeah. Okay. So again, you know, the whole bit of the impatience, you know, the immediate reconstruction of human society. That's, you know, I shouldn't have to say that for the 500th time. You know, that's, you know, that's how you trivially know that things are getting problematic, when everyone starts clamoring for some immediate gratification to their spiritual consciousness. You know, things are going to get very, very dicey then. All right.
162 years after the rebellion, a tidal wave swept over Dalmatia, and the planetary headquarters sank beneath the waters of the sea, and this land did not again emerge until almost every vestige of the noble culture of those splendid ages had been obliterated.
Can anyone...
Yeah, where is that?
Tell me what the... one thing that... is behind the almost word there? Almost every vestige?
Tablets.
Yeah, exactly, right? Remember? You know, if you flip back, you've got... get back to... you know, that... and many of the stones on which this law was inscribed now lie beneath the waters of the shores of Mesopotamia, off the shores of Mesopotamia and Persia. Yeah, so that's one thing, you know. And the key there is those are on stone. You know, remember, basically everything was built with brick and stuff. So, you know, it's only stone objects like that are going to survive after all this time.
And the writing wouldn't get worn away by the water?
Well, if apparently, you know, if they're saying that, it was chiseled in deep enough that, you know, especially if it's, you know, totally buried, you know, so that water's not washing over it. So there's that little detail. And then the big part of that, it's very important to not think fuzzy-like, like humans tend to do, when they use that colloquial term of tidal wave. Right. You know, the revelators, if it was a tsunami, they would have said tsunami. If it was a storm surge, they would have said storm surge. Okay. They very purposely selected the word tidal. Right. So what are they getting at there? Right. What makes the tides in the oceans? Gravity. Right. It's tidal. The al suffix means like. It's tide-like. It's related to gravity, like the tides. Right. And just the final word there, obliterated. That sounds like a person with purpose behind the act. I'm going to obliterate that. Like the Kalagastia panoramic rain records on Gerasim were obliterated. Okay, a storm surge didn't do it, right? Right. And then the other thing, you know, that you know, if you're reflecting, and this land did not again emerge until almost every vestige. What happened? The bastard physical controllers just lifted the ocean up and held it there for a while until it was all washed away.
Really think they did it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's easy for them to do, because all they have to do is just, you know, they have a natural anti-gravity presence, just, you know, let there be a little less gravity in that region and the ocean's going to be higher.
They can pull down on the land.
They have lots of means.
It's a gravity differential, right, that they're just putting in there. So the sea is just going to be a little higher there for a while and until it's all washed away, and then they let go of it and it goes back to normal. Okay.
One of those guys is a buddy.
Yeah.
They're hard to get to know. So.
Yeah, especially the impersonal ones, yeah. they don't talk much.
Somebody said that's a task.
Remember, we'll get to that. They don't talk much here. That's coming up next time. Yeah, yeah. Remember that the you can engage the personal ones, and then they direct the impersonal ones. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's it's important to recognize that that was done, and the final paragraph kind of gives you an idea of why that was done.
When the first capital of the world was engulfed, it harbored only the lowest types of the Sangic races of Urantia, renegades who had already converted the Father's Temple into a shrine dedicated to Nog, the false god of light and fire.
So, apparently the desecration was... Yeah, everyone decided, no, I've had enough. I just can't look at that anymore, that desecration of the Father's Temple. And so the Master Physical Controllers were ordered to just wash it all away. And when the slate was blank, everyone's, okay, that's much better. the one little interesting little sidelight in there is that, wow, way back then in that region, there was a fascination with a god of light and fire. You know, that kept going in that region. You know, Zoroastrianism picks up on it, you know, way down the road. So that's kind of a little interesting historical tidbit there, too. And you can also... appreciate the lowest types of the Sangic races, right, still plague that region of the world, too. Southern India, for instance, right?
Yeah. I can't help but have a negative reaction to this term obliterated, especially in the rain records. Because to me, it's like, what's the difference between this and book burning?
Right.
But it must have to do with the rain records must have relationship to eternity somehow. And when something goes that far askew to where there's no relationship to eternity, they preemptively destroy
it. Remember, I tried to point that out last time. You know, think about it in terms of truth instead of fact. Right, the truth of eternity.
Okay.
Right, and the opposite of that with iniquity. You know, that complete elimination of relationship to truth. Okay, we have many things that now, are thought of as very bad. But they're a universal part of the evolution of every world, right? They're part of the Father's way. Right? They're not innately divorced from eternity, right? There's a thread of truth flowing through slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive, for instance. Right? Now, and so you don't get to some point and obliterate the record of slavery, on Gerasim. Right? Because there's a thread of truth flowing through that. But, they are erasing that which is devoid of truth because it isn't really there in the first place. They aren't so fixated on facts like us, they don't, do everything possible to keep from some little language from dying off or something, for instance, things like that. Those are just the facts of time, and storing up your treasures on earth by trying to somehow white knuckle hold on to the facts of time and make and convince yourself that they're the truths of eternity.
Fool's errand.
Right, it's a fool's errand. You'll fail in the end anyway, because no matter how tightly you grip them, they aren't. You know, if you manage to absolutely grip them, you know, you just sever them and yourself from reality. Yeah, so that, see, there's a lot of lessons there, you know, and in our ever evaporating relationship to objectivity, as we think about the past, or as we think about those that are in the present, but still developmentally, you know, back in what is our past, you know, they're still in the nutrition epic or whatever, right?
Maybe it's not curious, but I just, the 40 loyal ones,
mm-hmm.
all but Van, were quickly taken off the planet.
Yeah.
They weren't left here to, you know, to keep civilization moving forward. It's like, that was done, they had done their, mm-hmm. it stayed loyal, and that was honored.
Yep.
They right. weren't made to stay here and...
Right, you're not going to try to kludge together or keep plan A going. No, you definitively go to plan B. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and we'll talk about that quite a bit next time, as a matter of fact. That's a good segue to thinking about how we'll wrap this paper up, you know, next time as we talk about those final details of how it worked in, you know, with the individuals that took over the reins of the planet. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.